Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. The philosopher Aristotle said, anybody can become angry. That is easy. But to be angry with the right person and to the right degree and at the right time and for the right purpose and in the right way, that is not within everybody's power and is not easy. Anger is a normal and healthy emotional state that serves to protect and defend us from threats to our safety and well-being. It functions to heighten our senses and to activate our nervous system as we prepare for conflict. It is an instinctual and very primitive response that we share in common with other animals. Unlike other animals, however, we as a species seem to have a very difficult time keeping anger in its place. Homicide is the second leading cause of death for people ages 15 to 24, and it's estimated that about one-third of female murder victims were killed by their husbands or boyfriend. The statistics about the consequences of anger go on and on. School shootings, bombings, random killings, rape, child abuse, bigotry, bullying, and assault are all in the news daily. My guest today knows something about anger. He is a counseling psychologist from Atlanta, Georgia, who has lived a rather remarkable life. As a junior in high school, he was active in integrating his local school in a St. Louis suburb. In 1958, while in college, he led a successful student movement to integrate the barber shops and motels in Ottawa, Kansas. As a newly married man whose wife hailed from the Deep South, he and his father marched in Selma, Alabama with Dr. King to stand up against depression and hate. He was a psychologist on Georgia's death row for 5 years, where he worked with guards and inmates to reduce violence. Based on that success, he was asked to work with staff at some of Georgia's worst prisons to reduce violence and maltreatment. He founded and ran a runaway center called The Bridge in downtown Atlanta in the early 1970s and started a transitional home for incarcerated youth. He worked to stem the escalating threat of violence in Grand Rapids, Michigan, following a series of riots across the country, and fought for women's rights in the 70s and 80s. He was active in the Men Stopping Violence movement, which worked to end aggression and violence against women. He also founded the Men's Experience, which was a support group for men who were working to learn how to be better men during the shifting tide of equality for women in the late 1980s. Over the last 20 years, he has found himself on a spiritual journey that has taken him from the jungles of Peru and Bolivia to the mountains of North America and the shores of the Georgian Bay. In those places, he has traveled with healers who have been practicing the same medicine for generations. He has been a counseling psychologist in private practice for over 30 years and has worked as a consultant for businesses and organizations throughout his career. Along the way, he's nurtured a loving marriage and raised two sons. He is my mentor, my friend, my role model, and my hero. He is my father, Dr. Bruce Pemberton, and even he gets angry. I want to remind our listeners that if you have questions for Dr. Pemberton, have a comment or a story that you want to share, you can reach us in three ways. The local phone number is 550-8433, or you can call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to reach us is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. You got to spell that out. Welcome to the show, Dr. Pemberton. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Well, thank you very much. That was quite an introduction. I hope someday when you're 75, your daughter will have a chance to read something like that to you.
Only if I'm worthy would that happen. I've been thinking about this topic for quite some time and wanting to figure out how to get it on the show, because it really seems that at the base of most people's problems lies sort of an underlying or unhealthy anger. As I was thinking, what do I call this show? I came up with the term toxic anger for the title, and I Googled it, and much to my dismay, it was not an original idea. that doesn't really surprise me that much. It seems that a lot of people are talking about the consequences of anger, and we're going to get into that. But before we do, I want to sort of have you go back and take a minute to discuss the foundation of your beliefs and why you chose this work, because that's really how when I read that, I was like, wow, that's pretty impressive. That really is your life's work, is dealing with anger in many, many different forms.
Well, when you said that to me and say it now, I'm quite struck that that's probably true. I wouldn't have phrased it that way until you did. But yes, from an early age, as early as I can remember, I was concerned about injustice. I remember on the playground in Boston, Massachusetts, some of my friends referring to one of our friends, one of the kids we played with, and as he left, they called him a Jew and said he didn't really belong in our neighborhood. And I didn't know anything about Jews, but I knew that he belonged. He was a friend. We all played with him. And so it struck me wrong. I don't think I did anything about that. But as I grew up and got older, I certainly more and more was struck by injustice. And that probably has something to do with my dad. He was a Harvard graduate, and he was in social ethics and was concerned about economic justice, and what felt that really the way ahead for all of us was that we get concerned with other people and that people treat each other as equally and with respect, regardless of what the situation. And so I think that got ingrained at a very early time for me.
Talking about my grandfather and my namesake, Dr. Prentice Pemberton, who is a Harvard-educated theologian, and really he wrote a book, Social and Economic Justice, and he was, the things I remember about him growing up is that he was always in his study writing and working and creating things that were working for people who were more disadvantaged. And so what you're saying is that was sort of your script or your story from early childhood. My grandmother was also a compassionate person and a part of that process.
Yes, they considered themselves having a joint mission to make the world a better place. And I think around the dinner table, we would talk about problems we had in school or talk about kids who weren't being treated fairly. And it was just something that I grew up, I feel very fortunate. I think people that get concerned about equal rights are those that have a lot of injustice in their life, and they react in the positive way to do something about that. And people who have a lot of guidance and a lot of instruction in that at a very early age. So it doesn't mean it's something that we all don't hopefully grow to in time. And I think that'll be part of our theme today. What do you do when a society or an individual or a couple is locked in anger that is really being destructive to them, that is making either both or one of their lives miserable? What do you begin to do to make a change, to move to a place where peace and reconciliation can exist?
There's a couple of experiences that I wanted you to talk about briefly that really do touch on anger and aggression and hatred. And one of the stories I remembered as a boy, and I forgot this story, was about the march in Selma with Dr. King, and that you and Dr. Pemberton, or my grandfather, participated in. Can you relate that story back? Because that's a good story.
Right. Well, my father called me. I was in Georgia with my wife. Her family lived in a farm just outside of Athens. And my father called me and said he was going to Selma to participate in the last movement into the capital of Montgomery to walk with in support of Martin Luther King. And so he was flying down and invited me to join him. So I did, and we went over there.
Now, this is early 60s, before I was around.
Yeah,
so
about 66,
right in the heart of it.
Right, yep. And we flew over, and we were compounded out at the airport, National Guard all around us, and the march began. We went in town about noon, and we were there, got in there at 2 o'clock. The streets were ringed, and the balconies at the hotels were ringed with people yelling and waving Confederate flags, and it was an explosive and dangerous situation. Later, there was one woman killed when they were supporting or transporting people back to the airport. So it was a nervous experience for me and for all of us. But there was about 50,000 or maybe 100,000 that showed up, and it was quite a powerful day. And at the end, Martin Luther King asked us all to join hands and to with whomever was near us. And a little boy about 10 years old, a black youngster, got between me and my father. And so we each have his hand, and all of a sudden a CBS News camera was in front of us and was focusing on our hands. My wife tells the rest of the story. She says she was sitting in her living room and with all of her friends and relatives, about 15 people sitting around, all watching this on CBS News, and she saw the hands, and it panned out, and then suddenly she saw it was my father and myself. And she froze and didn't swallow for a minute or two, and yet nobody noticed. They were all just sitting and talking about how these were outsiders and nobody in their right mind would participate in this kind of thing. And here she saw my dad and myself. So it was quite a moment. But, you know, it was a step. It was when... Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, we can go on and on about that, I'm sure. I just love that story about mom sitting in the room with Granny and Pop and all those
cousins. Well, you know the cast of characters.
I know the cast of characters, and they're wonderful and amazing people. But
yes, they are.
It was a different time, and it was a different ethic, and people had different views on, especially in the Deep South, on integration. Another story that your experiences on death row and working in Georgia for 5 years with some of the most toxic anger that's really available. I mean, talking about exposure to extreme anger. And at the same time, which I think is an interesting sort of, juxtaposition, for lack of a better term, but was the fact that you were working in the monasteries, the Trappist monastery in Conyers, at the same time that you were working on death row. Is that right? Do I have that right?
Yes. Even more powerful. I worked a day in each one for 5 years and each week. And they were both in white buildings at the end of a long drive off of the highway. And the drives were had magnolia trees on each side. So going into either one, the only difference was razor wire and a big fence around the white prison versus the monastery. But one of the things I came out of that experience with was that anger was not dealt with in either one of those places. It was acted out or was acted in. And so on death row, they had a court suit, and the court demanded that something happen because it had become so violent, and there was no services for the people. They were just sitting there totally, you know, on maximum security, 1 hour out of cell. And so the court made 26 decrees, and one of them was that a psychologist would go down there 1 day a week and meet with each inmate at least once a year. And so I did, and about, I met with them all, and then about 30 or 40 really dealt with the fact that they'd done something horrific to get there, or that they were going to potentially die. But death and dying work wasn't able to be done in the first 2 years because the violence was so predominant that nobody trusted anybody. At the same time, I began to notice that the correctional officers were just totally frozen. And when they'd go in, they went in all buckled up and all with their gear, and that they were just as toxic, they were just as angry, and just as, in a sense, defeated and asking to come off of death row over and over. Although some actually volunteered to go there because they liked the action, so to speak. But it wasn't a healthy place at all. Nobody was dealing with anything. So part of what I asked the warden was to work with the staff as well as the inmates after 3 months of looking and watching, and he allowed that. And so I met with five of the toughest officers and asked them who gave them the biggest problems. And they mentioned the guys who were dominating and controlling and really using violence and their lieutenants to control the place. And I said, if they changed, would you? And they said, we don't need to change. So I went to the inmates and I asked them, who are the officers that give you the hardest time? Who do you trust the most? And they said, we trust those five on the riot squad. And I said, why? Because they won't pass messages. They won't give us cigarettes. They don't do us any favors and we can't get anything on them. And I also know they won't set us up because there were correctional officers who would do a favor and then get bound to another inmate to set up another inmate. So it was a very unhealthy place. Long story short, I worked with those five inmates and I worked with those five officers, and they all began to slowly back off from their rhetoric or their expressions of anger, what I'd call toxic anger in the sense of what we're talking about it. One officer said he would go down and he'd see the guy, and he always gave him some rough words, and he got some back. His first step was to stop putting out rough words. Then he said, after about 3 days, I went down and I'd sort of looked at him, and he looked at me. And then the next week I would go down and I'd give him a little nod. And he said, you know, Mitchell nodded back at me. And then pretty soon he was saying, how you doing? Good. And pretty soon, within about 3 months, they were talking. And I knew something was going to happen. When I went there, the weapons they were getting out of the cell block were just voluminous. Every month they would do a shakedown, surprise shakedowns weekly, and get these incredible weaponry, you know, homemade shanks and that kind of thing. And at the end of my 5 years there, they were very seldom finding weapons in death row. There was no incidents, you know, very few disciplinary reports. No attacks on attacks. There were several, first year I was there, there were several inmates taken to the hospital emergency ward, you know, full of wounds. And the staff didn't get attacked for the last 4 years. So that
seems like what you did is you began a conversation.
Yes.
About anger and treating people with dignity and compassion and kindness. And that sort of took blossom and took root, even on death row, which is
yes.
really...
Well, I think I began to a conversation about hurt and pain, about how hard it was to serve time there and how hard it was to go to work when you were on that in that kind of violence.
We are going to, we could do this the whole hour, but we got to get to toxic anger. I want to remind our listeners, if you have questions for Dr. Pemberton or a comment or a story about your own life that you want to share, you can reach us in three ways. The local number is 550-8433. You can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to reach us is by emailing your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, so this concept of toxic anger, I guess we should go ahead and define toxic anger for our listeners, since it's not really a diagnosis or it's not a identified thing. Everybody's got a different opinion about what that means. So for the purposes of our conversation, what is toxic anger? How do you view it?
Well, I think toxic anger is probably two or three levels, you know, anyway, from anger that's held on to for a week or so, to anger that's acted out and does damage to self or other or property, or to anger that really spills all the way into doing physical and emotional abuse to family, friends, you know, anybody around you. So toxic anger could be explosive and powerful, or it can be nagging and just always present. You're always afraid that something will happen. It's not the use of anger in a way that solves problems. It creates problems.
I have, in the reading, I sort of have come across five kind of common denominators or common themes in toxic anger, and you've touched on three of them. Too frequent, too intense, lasts too long, leads to aggression, hurts family or work relationships.
Right. I think any time anger sits around and disrupts a relationship so that it's the prominent thing that everybody is worried about or talking about or experiencing, you know, the anger that stays a week or the kids that are afraid if they drop something, it will result in bad things happening to them or somebody around them. That's toxic anger. And usually we know toxic anger because we don't feel good about ourselves or somebody else doesn't feel good about the way they're being treated.
Right.
So people will tell you, or you'll experience frustration, and yet there are incredibly defensive modes or denial that comes into anger. It's the reason we have such a problem in our culture. They're just not willing to talk about it or look at it in themselves.
All right. I want to go on to the next, the impacts of children, but we did get a call that seems to be relevant to that on line six, and I wanted to get, I think we have a call on line six, and that is Rich. Welcome to the show, Rich. What can we do for you?
Well, I just like to ask the guest if he's familiar with somebody that has been completely forgotten and needs to be remembered. It's an incredible true story. The man's name is Warden Clinton B. Duffy, and he was the warden of San Quentin Prison for about 18 years, within which time there were only like three murders, and his wife would walk around, who was attractive, by the way, and his wife would walk around the prison, even in death row inmates, with no bodyguards. It's an incredible story. It's a true story. The Hollywood made a movie about it. And all those prison reforms that he instituted way back there in the 50s have all been ignored and forgotten, and his track record has been buried.
Wow. Yep. I'm familiar with the story of San Quentin. I wasn't familiar with he was the warden. And I congratulate you and glad you mentioned it on the show, because I think it's the kind of thing that can happen. There's a man that... wrote a book called Cry Twice, and he went into the Massachusetts Reform Schools, and he changed them totally. He said he walked through the first day, and he cried, and they hired him, and he worked 3 years, and he left. And he went back 6 years later, And everything that had been accomplished, where he felt very good about it, had all started again. So I think the cycle of violence can really come about, and you have to be alert to those kinds of things. Thanks for that call, though.
I found out about Clinton Duffy from another once famous person that was a well-known word in America in the media. His name was Bill Sands, and he wrote a bestseller book that was a bestseller for a long, long time. It was called My Shadow Ran Fast. He was inmate in San Quentin Prison who got paroled for, I guess, good behavior, whatever it was. But anyway, the school district where I went to school in California hired this man, and he would go around from school to school, and he used horrible language that was not allowed in those days. But the schools ignored it because whenever he spoke about this man, Clinton Duffy, and about prison reforms and this thing, there was not a peep. You could hear a pin drop, which is unusual in the high school, you know, to have that much instant respect for a speaker.
Yep.
So I wish somebody would bring this stuff up again, because I tried to help with some school programs in the local prison system about, I guess maybe it's 10 years ago now, maybe less, but you know, it's like we have a bad correctional system in America.
Well, Rich, you did bring it up, and I appreciate that. And I think there's probably some people out there that are listening to the local, that are from the local jails. And I do agree with you that lots of times, if we put people in cages and we treat them horrible, and then they're only going to get more angry. So I appreciate your call. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
All right. We have another call on 8. And Don, you're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to say I agree quite a bit with your previous caller. I think he brought up some real good points, as did you. I'm another one that's had some experience around some of the jails and things. And there's also, of course, other factors involved with why people are angry and the stress that gets generated on situations physically, like from the time a person goes in till they get out, whatever. And they're emotional as well as the stress is physically on them. Somebody wrote a book a while back, but referring to cardiac patients, that stress kills.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm in a household right now where it's very stressful. They got matters involving bipolar and a host of other things, diabetes and heart problems right down the line. And
mm-hmm.
You can wake up at any hour, day and night, and hear somebody screaming at the top of their lungs. But anyhow, it's some of the things that I've seen personally where the system itself, and the same thing can be said as far as teaching in the schools, that there's so much authoritarian aspect involved. You get the same thing with the lawyers and in some cases the judges, and that is they want you to just basically sit down, shut up, and do what you're told.
Yeah, well,
and it's the concept, of course, is that you have rights, and too often what has happened is people have either been misinformed or they have misperceptions involving their rights. Therefore, they're doing what basically they should not do. They're sitting down, shut up, and doing what they're told, and then they end up on doing time or something for something they didn't really do. And that in itself is a large cause for anger and whatnot.
Yeah, there's lots. Lots
come to me and say, "Look, I did this or that, but I didn't do that and that and that, and that's what they jailed me for."
Yep, there's lots of reasons for anger out there, and I realize that talking about death row probably struck us into a conversation about anger in institutions and how we're going to make places safer and more respectful. And yet I don't want to get lost in this, because I think also we want to talk about how this impacts everybody who's walking down their life. So I think we're going to move on from I don't want to take over my son's program here.
We have had some things right up here in Anchorage. I don't know how much aware of it you are, but over the last couple of decades, I mean, we've had people get shot just because they cut some driver off.
We are going to
put a bullet in our head.
Yep.
This is Prentice. We're going to get into some of the details of toxic anger and that very conversation a little bit further.
That is a great tip.
I think you termed it very right, though. The toxic anger is a very good way to coin the expression on it, because that's too often what anger is. It's toxic. Yep.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Don.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Take care. Caroline, you are on the air with Dr. Pemberton.
Thank you so much for this topic. I was raised in the rural South, born there in 44, and my father never allowed the race talk. He'd grown up around blacks and worked with blacks, and I didn't realize how unusual that is until I got a little bit older, and I could not understand how the Christians that I was around had their attitudes of the racism. Now, I was curious as to whether or not a couple of things. Number one, can people be reprogrammed? I believe they can. And number two, was part of this, I felt it in the South, was part of this perpetrator's guilt, because this in some families had gone back generations, and they were steeped in that hatred and that negativity.
Right. Great point. You know, one of the ways you change attitudes, if it's so incultural, you know, culturally standard as racism was and sexism and many of the isms in our culture, when anger is spills over, is that it is you have to change the laws. You have to change when there is sanctioning, when there's policy, you know, when there's reinforcement for discrimination in every way, down to, you know, bathrooms and theaters and all that kind of thing, then it's very difficult for people. They can live a good life, and yet also it's so enculturated into them. So laws need to be changed, and after the laws are changed, then attitudes can change. We can work in that kind of thing.
There's, well, I think there were some people who didn't believe in that, but they were bullied into it by their family members and others in their culture, in their society. And
absolutely.
I agree with you 100%, because I right now know that if it were not for the laws, it would go back exactly the way it were, the way it was in some of those areas. So it's a heartbreaking thing for those of us who lived amongst it, and I'm grateful to know that people can be reprogrammed.
Good.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for the call, Carolina. Yeah, I don't know that I get what you're saying about reprogram, but I think it is about an entire community, and it takes leaders standing up and a few people. And I think that's standing up in a nonviolent and non-aggressive way to start to begin to talk about change and to talk about compassion and peace. And I think that's the piece that folks like Martin Luther King and Gandhi did so well. I mean, all these movements, I believe, are generated by anger. But change comes from healthy anger. And, you know, Dr. Pemberton, I'd like for you, I almost called you dad, but, you know, I guess that's kind of automatic.
I think
but
that's both.
I would like for you to talk about that concept of passive resistance and how it is a peaceful movement, but it is fueled by anger.
Right. Well, there comes a time, of course, when violence will be used against violence, and we have examples of that all over the world. And sometimes that's the only way. I mean, there is a reason for having police with weapons and that kind of thing, and armies. But all the great movements has changed in a peaceful way, or brought about change slowly, have been very peaceful. And I know there's all kinds of examples where that wasn't true, but Martin Luther King and Gandhi and Thich Nhat Hanh, Vietnam, there's hundreds of people in the world who are saying we can't deal with violence with violence. And I take that right down to a couple. If there's battering in the home and a woman is trying to stand up to the man and he's bigger and stronger and he hits, then I urge the woman not to hit back. And we try, and that is not submitting at all, because the point is to get the man in a point where he gets some help, but it's not going to be helpful to do violence with violence. So how this concept of how to have your voice and how to develop your own strength in the face of violence is very, in the face of toxic anger, how to use positive power, how to have your power in the face of that is hopefully something that one person today will get something from what we're talking about.
That goes back to Aristotle's quote about anger is easy, but the right person to the right degree at the right time for the right purpose in the right way. That's what Gandhi and Martin Luther King, I believe, had figured out.
And so many of us do not have any experience with that. We do not have parents who can resolve conflict well. People in alcoholic families, violent families, grow up with just seeing the power to control and the power to intimidate. And when fear and anger are the combination of what we grow with, our choices are very, very little. That's where we need a lot of help. And I think I'm sure we're going to talk about that before we leave the air, about how people get that kind of help and skill.
I hope we will. We'll get there. I guess we're right up against the break right now, so we'll go ahead and take that. I want to remind people that you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. Our local number is 550-8433. You can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And an email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with our guest, Dr. Bruce Pemberton. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, Your Health Connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just joining us, I have in studio Dr. Bruce Pemberton, a psychologist from Atlanta, Georgia, who also happens to be my father. Today, we are discussing the consequences of toxic anger and what we can do to better manage our anger. You can email questions to line1@alaskapublic.org, call locally at 550-8433, or toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, if you're listening tonight between 9 and 10 p.m., you will be hearing a tape recording. All right. Moving right along, let's get into the sort of, we've done more of the institutional stuff, but I'd really like to get into the impacts on children who are exposed to domestic violence and aggression and toxic anger in our community and our families. There's a story. I was talking to my daughter the other day, and we were hanging out alone, and it's my 3-year-old, and she was talking to me, and she was saying, "Okay, Daddy, you play with me?" And I said, "Sure, let's play." And so I said, "What do you want to play?" And she said, "Let's play Mommy Daddy." And I said, "All right." And so she got the razor out of the bathroom, and she gave it to me, and she said, "Do this." And I said, "Okay." And I shaved, and she said, "That's what daddies do." And I said, "Yeah, that's what daddies do." And then she said, "Let's go to the park." So she got her baby, and she said, "Hold hands." And I said, "Okay." And she said, "This is what mommy daddies do." And I said, "Yes." And then she wanted a kiss, and it got a little bit weird. But, you know, she was getting her example. And sometimes for me, I mean, I read about this stuff. I do it every day in my office. I talk about anger and modeling and the importance of it. But to have a 3-year-old tell me those things and reflect back to me my own behavior about subtle things, she's watching and she's learning and she's... her experience of the world and of what a man and what a woman, what they do and who they are, she's picking all that up before the age of 3, and that really just drove it home at
a
deep level.
And I'm sure some of your listeners have already made the connection with children, since that was the topic we wanted to hit, and no pun intended. But children who are raised in a violent family, by the age of 3, they would say the same thing. They would hit their sister, or they would hit a kid in school. And if there was a parent who would sit down, and probably not there, but sit down and say, "So why are you hitting?" They say, "Well, that's what daddies do." And or in some cases, that's what mummies do.
Well, that's a lot of times what child therapists do with their children, with the kids they get if they're pre-verbal or they're like 2, 3, mm-hmm. 4, they give them dolls and they say, let's play family. And, you know, the dad's whacking or yelling or, you know, being mean. And you get your information from that.
Right. And the consequences on that are incredible.
We have a call that, I'll let Mary explain why she's calling. Go ahead. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi. I am fascinated by this because I never have dealt with any of this sort of thing because I was well treated as a kid and so on and so on. I learned all of this stuff in, surprise, surprise, dog training.
There you go. Yep.
But it works, and it, as I observed doing this on dogs, I used it on people, and I haven't yelled at anybody for years.
And you've been fairly effective.
Or even become enraged just within myself. You know, I don't raise my voice.
So going to dog training, Mary, going to dog training helped you learn how to control your anger? Is that what you're saying? Or
It taught me how to communicate with somebody that wasn't necessarily speaking my language.
Ah, nice.
And to deal with any problems we had calmly and so on, because when you're training a dog, as soon as you frighten it, it turns into a wild animal.
There you go.
But you need to be assertive and direct and strong and firm, correct?
And you need to reinforce
positive. I've never hit any of my dogs, and I've been raising dogs and training them and showing them for 40 years.
My wife and I do couples therapy together, and our dog is sometimes in the office with us. And whenever a couple comes in, we let the dog go from behind our chairs up to say hello to them once. Then he comes back behind the chair, and he always wants to do a second loop, and we sort of talk to him and say, you have to do this kind of thing. And so we'll let him go a second time, say hello to the couple, and then he lies down. And one day the wife said to her husband, the couple, said, now, that's what we have to have. That's the way our son should be, you know, that we can have that kind of response from him. And the father said, you wouldn't want to do to our son what they had to do to get that dog to act that way. And my wife raised up. We do couples therapy together. She's also a psychologist. She raised up and she said, I'll have you know that dog has never been touched nor talked to in anger. And raising a dog, you do it with positive reinforcement. And when you want to extinguish something, you withhold reinforcement, because if you punish, you will create scare. And once someone is scared, the communication is lost, even whether it's a human or a dog.
Thank you for the call, Mary.
My training was, I had a marvelous trainer the first time around. This is way back, 44 years. It fell over into my dealing with human beings, and I didn't notice it for a long time, but it works.
Yep, it sure does.
I mean, it's just,
we can learn lots of lessons.
Or move the dog into the position I wanted it to be, but not by jerking it around or anything, just by putting my hands on it, petting its ribs, and saying, good, that's fine. And it works on people. You don't have to necessarily move them around, but if you explain yourself calmly and indicate that you give a hoot about how they feel, it works.
Thank you, Mary. Those are good lessons for how to treat people.
Yeah, okay. I learned it in the dog training class.
Yes.
But it fell over into dealing with human beings, and I noticed how much nicer people were and how much easier my life was.
All right, Mary. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
All right. I have an email I'd like to share from Sheen in Anchorage. And this email sort of sums up, I think, what we're hoping to get across in this show. So I'll just read it. From the time I was a teenager to about my late 20s, I was angry all the time. It didn't matter how small or insignificant the incident. I would get mad and stay mad for an unreasonably long period of time. I got into fights with my wife and would stay mad for a week or more sometimes. I would not talk to her and completely shut her out. My kids were scared of me, and so were other people. My anger was one of the big factors that broke up my marriage of 7 years. It took many years of counseling before I would figure out that I cannot control others or their actions. The only person I can control is myself. I can stay angry and waste a lot of energy and ultimately change nothing, or I can let it go and move on. I try to conduct myself in a way that won't embarrass me or my family. Learning that the problems I had were mostly of my own doing and learning to deal with them in a positive way ultimately got my wife and me back together. We were married again last May. My kids and many others have noticed how I have changed over the years. All aspects of my life are much better and happier now. I am proud of the work I have done controlling my anger, and my family is proud of me too.
You know, if somebody changes from an angry stance in life, toxic or mini-toxic, so to speak, into having their voice and being direct and having conversation and communicating, they will, if they begin to work on that in therapy or in a program like anger management and it's taking hold, before they know they have changed anything, people will begin to tell them that. And it's always fascinating that they'll come back into therapy or they'll come like he did.
Yeah.
And they'll say, you know, my kids say there's something going on. I don't think I'm doing anything different. So then we'll explore, what are you doing different? Because people have to understand what they're doing that makes them more effective.
Yeah, that was a beautifully written letter, and I think it does illustrate exactly what you're saying, that if we begin to make these changes, people will see it. I mean, I had a client that came in recently who's been doing a lot of this work, and when he walked in, I looked at him when I walked out into the lobby, and I was like, wow, you look very serene. And he said, I'm feeling it, man. I'm feeling it. And what he meant was the peace and dealing with some difficult things in his life, some challenges that before would have sent him into a rage. And he was just, I think what Sheen wrote in this email, that's exactly what is happening for him as well.
Well, you know, we're moving into some of the things people might do.
Yes.
And one of the things I'd like to mention is that what you just said reminds me of a man I was working with who had been in a very abusive, he was abused by his father and saw his mother being abused. And as an adult, when the kids were little, his anger spilled over and he treated them roughly. And he said, you know, I hit them and I didn't like it. And he hadn't done that in 10 years and he was a fairly effective man. He's fairly satisfied, but he felt awful about the old behavior. And I said to him, well, why don't you go home and tell your son? He said, he's not listening to me. He's acted out. He's all over the place. He's an angry young man. He won't hear a word. So, you know, one of the things he did finally, a year and a half later, he went home, he got his son's attention, he sat down, and he apologized. Not only did he apologize, but he said, you know, sometimes I still get angry and I don't treat you well. I yell, or I even threaten, or I hit the wall. And he said, I'm not going to do that anymore. When I'm mad at you, I'm going to put it into words. I'm going to find a way. I can tell you, never again am I going to, and if you are afraid of me when I am angry, please tell me. He said within 3 months, his son was doing better in school. Everything began to change. He felt differently. His wife was amazed. And it went right down the line to his daughter and to a younger child who was in the home. So I think owning where you've been and what you've done to the people that have receive the, you know, we tell other people we're sorry.
Right.
We tell our friends at work we're sorry. You know, I just wish I hadn't. And we have all those regrets. We even tell our therapist. But how do you go home and get it right?
I had a man once tell me that if he felt like if he apologized to his son, it felt weak.
And, wow.
I thought that was interesting.
He was feeling vulnerable.
Yeah. And that, for men, that is, that is just a weakness, right?
Yes, but I'd like to change the words, because vulnerability is the essence of intimacy. When we can be vulnerable with those we love, they can see us as we are. Getting our voice and being seen as we are and making that all okay is a healthy family.
I think it's important to realize that for men, vulnerability, you can just put that little, you know, parallel equal sign right next to it equals weakness.
Yes.
Yeah.
One of the things we did I worked with a group of women back in the 80s when you said we were trying to find our way to deal with strong women.
Yeah.
So we did a joint Saturday morning workshop, and all the men got in a fishbowl in the middle with the women watching.
Uh-huh.
And the assignment we gave ourselves was to talk about our fear and trembling, when we were really afraid. And so we did that. A couple of men cried, and we talked about times when we were weak and scared. And then we went outside, and the women came in, and we asked the woman, went in with them, and the woman later said, "So what did you all feel?" All the women said they felt terribly uncomfortable.
Hmm.
They didn't know how to, you know, they wanted to go, they wanted to say something. It was hard for them not to interrupt the men being scared. Well, then we switched it, and the topic for the women was talk about your anger. And they did. They started very slowly, but within about 10 minutes, they were just going, and they were talking about how angry they are with men. And we were scared. And so when we got inside, we asked, "Okay, guys, what was it like to hear women really talking about their anger?" They said, "It was very uncomfortable." So I think, you know, men have a hard time talking about, and women have a hard time listening to men being vulnerable. It's kind of, we all put it in, we make it difficult in our society to be intimate both ways.
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction because, for men, anger's easy. And for women, I think vulnerability, at least, you know, in the stereotype is, and I think it's true in practice, that women are more comfortable with feelings and emotions and some of that. And they tend maybe to repress their anger more than men. And repressed anger is another part of toxicity that can really have significant impacts. And I just want to mention real quickly, but because we're running out of time, but anger has, and repressed anger, I think, is, and toxic anger have some significant, since this is Line One, Your Health Connection, there are some significant health consequences that I just want to mention real quick. But the flood of stress chemicals, and I think somebody else was talking about this, one of the callers, associated with the metabolic changes that accompany unmanaged or repressed anger, that causes headaches, digestion problems, insomnia, increased anxiety, depression, high blood pressure, skin problems like eczema, heart attack, and stroke. And I think those are significant reasons, even if you're not thinking about how you can improve your relationships and your overall happiness. I mean, I think those are good reasons to learn how to manage and express healthy anger.
Right. Well, I'm not sure we said it clearly, but I think toxic anger is anything that goes on. You know, when it's anger, you can't help but have anger.
Automatic.
Right. We have a flash of anger. And then we have a brief space. In fact, one of your former people that I listened to with you mentioned that there's a time in between the time we act on it. And our real power is in what we do with that time between. So if we don't do anything, and if we hold on to that anger for a long time, we don't have a voice, we don't communicate, we try to manage it by ourselves. And it's terribly toxic. The hormones that are released when anger is held for a long time begin to wear us down. Those hormones help us for the first 30 seconds to a minute. They activate us.
Right.
But when we hold that activation, we're just eating ourselves up. We tire ourselves. We can't sleep. We get anxious. We get depressed. So I think it's important to find that way to act in that brief moment when we to soothe ourselves, to calm ourselves.
You're referring to Dr. Baith.
Yes.
And she was talking about Dr. Frankl's quote, Dr. Viktor Frankl, between the stimulus and the response lies a space, and in that space is our freedom and our growth. And then she added, in that space, we practice our skills. And so if you're doing anger management, part of the goal is to increase that space, as she was talking about, and that's where you do your work.
Yes. On
learning healthy ways to communicate your anger.
And when we come to toxic anger, often we don't have skills to practice in that space. So we have to learn skills. And that means we have to acknowledge there's a problem, become aware of it, accept it, and then ask for help.
Is that the first step to change?
Oh, absolutely. Changing anything.
Anything.
Is to be aware of it. And then the second step is to accept it. We can be aware of something and then denial rushes in and we say, "I'm not angry. I'm not like my father. I don't hit anybody with a 2x4. We can go on and on and on in ways that we're not an angry person because. And anytime we hear the because, we kind of say, well, let's back up and just, how come everybody says you're angry except you? And once a person can accept that there may be something that's not functioning well and that there's better possibilities, and that's the power of a group. That's why a lot of the groups, the Men Stopping Violence and support groups and anger management and 12-step, all happen in a group because other men who have been there can begin to talk to that man about his anger in a way that, he can discount a therapist, but he can't discount somebody who has a story of getting in trouble with his anger.
I have an email here, and it is from, let me look, it is, I'll just read it. I am married to a man who is still very angry with me for an extramarital affair I had 3 years ago. We've been married 8 years. Whenever the anger boils up, he targets me. Never physical abuse, but making me fearful of yelling or talking me down in a sarcastic manner. I'd almost rather get punched. My question is how to quell this anger, help him realize that his anger is misplaced with limited resources. How can our pastor, me, or our family talk him down or help him let go? His anger is causing high blood pressure, increased stress on his body, and all that stress, all the stresses that go along with it.
You want me to take that one?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, anger makes sense in a case like that. When there's an affair, the person feels wounded and abandoned and all the vows have been violated, and there may be shame on the partner who's going to stay and wants to stay and comes back. And also the man can be very angry. But when it stays on like that, there's no positive use for that kind of anger which stays around. So what I think has happened, and I noticed that she said he's not hit me, he's not transgressed that space, but he scares me. And that's a sign, as I said earlier, that something's going on where the anger is not being productive. And so she said, what can I do to help? And that's a tough one. She cannot, she said, sometimes I almost want him to hit me. Often when women are in an abusive situation and the anger is building, women who have been abused a lot sometimes just say, let's get it over with, and go to it. So it's not going to be helpful that way. A couple like this needs counseling, needs good therapy. She can say, I need some help. I feel bad about what I did, and I'd like you to go with me so that we can get back to where we were before. There needs to be invitations, and if it doesn't work, she can get some help and she can get some therapy herself. But this is the kind of couple I love to work with because they haven't found a way to rebuild trust, and that's very hard when affairs happen, but it's not impossible. In fact, everything can move. She's made a choice to be there, and he's not appreciating it. He can screw it up big time at this point.
Yeah, and I think the first thing that jumps out into my mind is she does have a pastor, and I think connecting with that pastor and talking about that forgiveness. But the thing that jumps out at me is that he is stuck in anger, and that has become toxic. And I think of it like a radiation poisoning. If you get exposed to too much radiation, then down the line, years later, there's birth defects, there's cancer, there's things, and people are like, where is this coming from? Well, a certain amount of radiation is normal. It's in the atmosphere. It's from the sun. But toxic exposure to too much can create long-term effects. And I think that's what she's talking about, is he is stuck in that angry place, and it's got these tendrils of toxicity and poison that's in their marriage and their relationships, and she wants some help.
And often men like that will not own that there's a problem that they have with it. They say nothing, this would not be a problem if, because. And any time you hear if she hadn't or because she did or something like that, and the anger is still present, then the man does have a problem. Then the couple does need help. Sometimes with pastors, there's not the, and it depends. There's some great pastoral counseling. And so that's the way to go and try it. But often there'll be a focus on the shame, or there'll be a focus on, that maybe he does have reason. Our society can deny that toxic anger can be justified, and that's not going to be helpful. But You know, I do think that the guy can get some help.
He absolutely has a right to be angry and upset.
Yep. And your example of radiation, the trouble with radiation is 20 years later, your skin begins to
peel off.
And people aren't sure why that happened. But you know, with toxic anger, 20 years later, when everything blows up or when the woman leaves or when the kids get big and they're acting out, it's not long before people say the anger is the reason. Because anger in the short term is helpful. Anger that goes on and stays and becomes entrenched is terribly, terribly damaging.
I got one more email and then we are running up against it. I've heard that men often translate, and maybe we've touched on this, men often translate all emotions into anger because it's the only emotion acceptable for men to express. Any truth to this? How can these people channel emotions other than anger?
Well, I'd like to think a lot of men do have other emotions that they can channel, but I think your generalization is probably fairly accurate, that it seems like men, the easiest anger response is anger, and society encourages that through movies and through books and through examples about how men are he men and all that good stuff. I was disagreeing a little bit because I think a lot of men are getting sensitive and trying to figure out how to be better partners and how to be more in relationship and more intimate, because anger, any extended anger, toxic anger, has no place in intimacy.
My good friend from high school, Eric Thomas, said that he says to me all the time, "Your dad ruined it for the rest of us. He's the original sensitive guy."
Darn.
And that's what he's talking about. We are out of time. We're running up. So any parting thoughts you want to leave with folks about anger, toxic anger, for our listeners?
Well, as simply as I can put it, I think anger is natural. If it goes on more than 30 seconds and there's not a beginning process of thinking about it or moving, trying to figure out what to do,
right,
then it begins to become problematic. If it goes on for a couple of days, or if people sandbag it, or if people can never forget, there's a kind of anger that goes underground and then 3 months later it comes up, and you'll hear this all the time with couples. They never forget. So if that's sticking around, if it's feeling dysfunctional, if you're not feeling related, men can use anger to get in the way. Women can too. So that's when it's time to get some help.
All right. Thanks a lot to today's guest, Dr. Bruce Pemberton. If you'd like to continue today's conversation, join KSKA on Facebook. You can find the link on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can let us know your thoughts about today's show at our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We welcome any and all feedback and are especially interested in hearing your thoughts on subjects of interest for the monthly mental health segment of Line 1. Line 1 will not air next week due to the Labor Day weekend, but Dr. Woodard will return in 2 weeks when his guest will be pediatrician and children's librarian Dr. Nipish Navsaria of the University of Wisconsin. They will be discussing the important effects of reading and stress on early childhood brain development. So why not tune into your health and learn more Monday, September 9th at 2 o'clock p.m., repeating at 9 p.m. on KSK. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Public Media. Kristen Platt is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for listening. I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.